Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad you're here. It's a very dull meeting if you weren't here. I see some people have to stand, and I always feel bad about people having to stand. And then a little voice says, "What the hell? You've got to stand." We had a nice time coming down, Max and I, and then on the way we picked up Kim and Brad and drove down with them and then met Pat and Diane and went to a Japanese restaurant and had Japanese food and had enough teriyaki steak left over to feed our two Ala dogs, Lily and Sabrina. They're out in the car, they said to tell you hello, and they come to all our meetings. They come to the AA meetings with me, and Max comes to AA with me. Thank you. And they come to the Al-Anon meetings. Max goes to Al-Anon, and I go to Al-Anon too. And the dogs go to both AA and Al-Anon. They go to more meetings than any of us. And they go to more meetings than a lot of people are trying to stay sober. And they have nicer personalities than a lot of people are trying to stay sober. I was talking at a meeting last night. I was feeling around here in my pockets, and I was talking at a meeting last night, and the guy handed me a card, a prayer on it, and it has my name on it. It says Paul, and then it says Paul means humble, and I was so glad to hear that. I've always wondered why I was so humble, and I was glad to find that out. I thought Paul meant small, and I've always hated that name, but now I'm happy to find that I'm humble. Somebody once said that I had a lot of humility. That I've never used any of it yet. And I am humble. Walt was asking me about the IDAA convention that we were at in Scottsdale just recently. And IDAA is for International Doctors in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that an impressive title for a bunch of drunks wanting to get together and talk about sobriety? Yeah. And be able to charge it off as a business expense? But I was asked to talk there. And that, I was delighted because that filled a lifetime fantasy for me. I have always wanted to be invited someplace to talk to a group of doctors about the diagnosis and treatment of a serious medical problem where I could talk as an authority. And I don't like to travel. It's not that I'm afraid of airplanes or heights or anything, just that I find it boring, and I'd rather stay home and talk to the phone and go to meetings than waste my time in airports and so on. But anyway, I was willing to fly to Sweden or wherever it is that the King gives the Nobel Prize in Medicine. I thought if they were willing to give it to me, the least I could do is to be there, go there and receive it. And I was going to get the Nobel Prize for developing a cure for cancer, diabetes, high blood pressure, a few medical problems. And you remember the movie Amadeus, where the I identified with the, not with the Mozart, the musician, I identified with the villain, Salieri. Remember Salieri in the beginning of the movie? He attempted suicide, and at the end of the movie he was in the insane asylum and he was giving his blessing to the other inmates. And Salieri, God drove Salieri crazy. I really identified with Salieri. What Salieri wanted was, he was a hard-working musician, and he wanted God to make him famous. Now, he was willing to work hard, but he wanted God to give him the fame. And instead of giving the fame to him, he gave it to this little jerk Mozart. And it literally drove Salieri crazy. And I identified with him, because that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to win the Nobel Prize in Medicine and get famous. And when I was famous, then I would give all the credit to God. I was going to make God famous. all he had to do was make me famous first. And I would do all the work. All he had to do was give me the cause for cancer and high blood pressure and diabetes. And few though, he already knows those things, and all he had to do was tell me. And that's all he had to do was give me a few little secrets, and I would become famous, and I'd make him famous. I thought it was a real bargain. But he never bought it. He never bought it. He not only didn't make me famous, he made me anonymous. And I want you to speak directly into the microphone. My name is Paul, and I'm a real alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you're here. And Lily and Sabrina are glad you're here. I have gone through a lot of trouble to create this story, and I'd sure hate to have you miss it. But I imagine you could stay sober without it. I don't know if I could. Anyhow, I enjoyed being an alcoholic. I really enjoyed being an alcoholic. This is the best life I've ever known. I enjoy this way of life. I enjoy what my disease does to me, such that I have to do the things I have to do that make my life so much better. And I hear people say they're not glad to be an alcoholic, but they're glad to have the program. Well, I don't know what good it would be to have the program without having the disease. I don't see very many people knocking the doors down trying to come in and work our program if they're not alcoholic or somehow connected with alcoholism. So I'm glad to be an alcoholic. And if that bothers you that I say that, talk to your sponsor. If you don't have one, get one. Yeah. If your sponsor doesn't, can't explain it to you, get a different sponsor. So anyway, it's a good way to go. Another thing about meeting with Brad and Kim. Brad and I are meeting every Tuesday night, and 12 of us get together, and we are studying the first 102 pages of the book and doing the steps as we come to them. I picked up some mimeograph sheets down in Texas one time, or they were from Texas, where they would get together and have a group of whatever size they wanted and meet for 20 weeks in order to study the book and do the steps as they come to them. And nobody could join the group once they started, and you hopefully wouldn't drop out once you started. So it wasn't a step study, it's a step do it. And I got these sheets and cleaned them up and edited and made a pamphlet out of it. And so that's what we're working on, is going through the steps. And the point is, this will be the fifth time I have done all the steps thoroughly in 26 years. And so it's about every 5 years it averages. I didn't set it out that way, it just happened that way. Now, I know there are people that say they only do the steps once, and that's it. You just do the maintenance steps, 10, 11, and 12 thereafter. And I think people who do it once and don't do it again should only do it once and not do it again. And the people who do the steps every year on their birthday, they ought to do it every year on their birthday. Whatever anybody does, that's the way they ought to do it. But I'm just saying what I've done. And the thing I find interesting about doing it the way I have no plans for the future, but the way I have done it, every time I've done the steps, I've moved to a new plateau in my sobriety. Just like the first time I did them. I went from where I was up into a plateau, and now I've done that every time this way. And I guess the point I was trying to make is that if you're having a hard time right now, and you don't know what to do, and things are bad, and if it's been a while since you've done the steps, you might consider doing them over again. And in fact, if it's too early if people tell you it's too early in your sobriety to do that, to take a fourth or fifth step, you tell them, I gave you permission to do them over again at no additional charge. But I find my answers in the steps. I find it's a good way for me to go. In fact, I said something I've been sober 26 years. That was the last day of last month. I celebrated my 26th birthday. And actually, you're just nowhere near as impressed as I am. That's 26 years. 26 years is the longest I have ever gone without a drink. Now, 26 years is a long time between drinks for me. I had no plans of going that long. In fact, when I came to AA, I didn't really want to talk about drinking. I wanted to talk about my problems. I came to AA via the note ward of the hospital I was on the staff of, and the only reason I came to AA was that getting a pass to go to AA was the only way I could get off the nut ward. And when I got out of the nut ward, I had no intentions of continuing to go to these dumb meetings because I wasn't even an alcoholic. I forget what I started to say. Was anybody listening? I wasn't listening. I got so fascinated with being on the nut ward. I didn't like it. It was a strange nut ward. They had a fascination there with making leather belts. They were trying to convince me that my life would be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. That made no sense to me at all. I mean, I tried to point out to them that I have a whole wall full of licenses and degrees, diplomas and papers to prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence, and they're trying to tell me that my life would be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. And well, that wasn't my fault. That was the fault of that occupational therapist, because I've always had a theory that if you don't understand a thing well enough, you can explain it to me, so I understand it, and you don't understand it as well as you're supposed to. And she had already explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking a 4th time. And as a matter of fact, it's an odd thing, too. I went to an AA meeting. That was a problem in itself. I remember sitting there at the ward, commiserating with myself about the things that had gone wrong, that a nice guy like me had ended up in a place like that. And I said, the misdiagnosis and the poor medical management and the poor care that I got and the things that went wrong. And I was really feeling quite sorry for myself. And this dumb psychiatrist, who couldn't see that my problems were marital, walked up to him and he wanted to know if I would talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God almighty, Doc, you know, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? I didn't even know anything about alcoholism. Didn't want to know anything about alcoholism. Certainly didn't want to treat any alcoholics. You treat one, if word spread, you'd get them all. They'd all be coming to you. Yeah. A whole lot of alcoholics. Then all your good patients would know you treat alcoholics, and they'd stop coming. So all you'd have would be alcoholics. And they never pay their bills or come on time when they have an appointment anyway. But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on the nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I said, yes, and no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room yelling, my name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic, ha 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 ha. I felt sorry for him. The only thing in life he had to brag about was the fact that he was an alcoholic. And I was a lot more impressed when I found out he was an attorney. And all I remember about his story was it was long. My God, it was long. It was an interminable story. And in a loud voice, he shouted everything. He said, us drunks, us alcoholics, and alcoholics and alcoholics. I thought, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? And these people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that? And I don't remember a word he said, I remember how he ended. He finally said, well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it, but I'll go. Because I figured he'd go back and tell that dumb psychiatrist. And he would have. And I went to the meeting. And I have no idea what meeting we were at, or what they said, or who led, or who prayed, or anything that happened to me. But I know the meeting had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He was delighted. And he wanted to know all about the meetings, and what are the kind of meetings they had, and what's this about steps, and what's this about a book, and how often do they have meetings, and when are you going back again? And I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. And I wondered how many meetings I'd have to go to before I could get him sober so I could go home. And I went to all the meetings I could. Finally got discharged, and I had no intentions of continuing to go, but my problem was that Max had decided she liked the meetings. And she did something she couldn't do. Well, of course, once I found out she liked them, then I decided, when she didn't act right, I decided I wouldn't go into AA anymore. I'd punish her. And then she decided she did something she couldn't do. She got in the car and drove all the way to Laguna Beach. We lived in Anaheim. She went to Laguna Beach. We all went to meetings in Laguna Beach, so we wouldn't run into anybody we knew. Now I've run into everybody that goes to Laguna Beach, so they won't run into anybody they know. And she got in the car and she drove down the freeway and went to the meetings by herself, something she couldn't even do. And I don't know if you've ever tried that. Sitting at home on a Saturday night drinking while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting. I found it very boring, and had to go back to the meetings to find out what they were laughing about. And seemed to me they laughed at anything. They laughed at nothing. Laughed at everything. But and that sounded embarrassing. They laughed at things they ought to be embarrassed about. They even laughed at their drinking, for God's sake. One night, 7 months later, I found myself laughing with them, and I haven't had a drink since. And I think the laughter has a lot to do with the recovery. In fact, I found that when alcoholics laugh, my higher power laughs. Even when he doesn't get the joke. He just enjoys the laughter, and he laughs along with him. And that's good for me. And I haven't had a drink since I started laughing with him. And as I say, that was 26 years ago. And I was talking to, to meetings. I wanted to talk about my problems. That's what I was talking about when I lost my point. You thought I'd never get back to it, didn't you? I wanted to talk my problems. They wanted to talk about drinking. And it took me the 7 months to find out that my drinking was the mother of all my problems, that I had to take care of that first. The interesting thing I found about that, I think I said this earlier, was that what I have to do to keep from drinking is the same thing I have to do to solve the problems that I thought were driving me to drink. And in fact, I thought Max was driving me to drink, and as a matter of fact, I do think she drove me to drink. Oddly enough, we were married, about 28 years, I think, when we came to the program. And we're still married, and December the 2nd of this year, we will have been married 54 years. And I'll drink to that. And that's been an interesting thing to work on, and because I have these people in my head. I don't know how things are with you, but I don't know how you think, but I think with somebody is talking, always talking, talk. If I'm awake, and even much of the time when I'm not awake, I'm dreaming, but all that time there's conversations going on in my head. I have these people that live in my head. And they talk all the time. They talk. All the time talk. That's all they do, as a matter of fact. They never do any work. They just talk. And they don't even agree with each other. It isn't as if they're just talking, talk. They get to fighting and arguing back. Well, they're doing it now, as a matter of fact. They get up there, and if one of them decides something I ought to talk about, and the other one says, no, don't talk about that. Talk about what I want to talk about. And they say, no, I don't want to talk about that. And they get to arguing back and forth. And it's real hard for me to stand here and have a conversation with you with them chattering away in my head. And I'm trying to get ideas from them but not be distracted by them. And I think, my God, why don't you shut up there, you know? And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. And they But my life is determined by how I get along with those people up there. If they say it's a terrible world, it's a bad day, everything is awful, I have a terrible day. And if they think it's a great day and everything is wonderful, I have a good day. That's what I started to say about the marriage. I said this recently, that one of the people in my head is obsessed with Max.
Yourself.
He's obsessed with Max, and he's constantly watching her. And he doesn't really care much for her. And he's always reporting back to me what she just said, or what she just did. Did you notice the tone of voice in which you just said that? What kind of a man would live with a woman that would talk about him like that? You know? And always pointing out these things about her, negative things. He's always able to find something negative to complain about, too. But there's another one up there that's just as obsessed with Max, but he likes her. And he likes to report to me, too, things about... He'll say things about, isn't she attractive? Or doesn't she have a great sense of humor? Aren't you lucky you have somebody that went to AA, or went to AA meetings, even though they were an alcoholic, and you didn't want to go? Aren't you lucky that she still goes to Al-Anon? Aren't you lucky that she's so active in the program? Aren't you lucky to have her? Isn't she attractive? My marriage depends on which one of those two people I listen to. Apparently, they're both right. That's the law of, Brad and I were talking about this earlier. That's the law of appreciation. The law of appreciation says that here on earth, every person, place, thing, situation, meeting, institution, corporation, law, or any combination thereof, has both good and bad in it. If there is a place called heaven, maybe up there everything will be 100% good. And if there's a place called hell, maybe there everything will be 100% bad. But here on earth, everything, every person facing its situation has both good and bad in it. The trick is, if you watch the good, it gets gooder. And if you watch the bad, it gets badder. I'm sure you've had the occasion to feel bad and have some goof tell you to write a gratitude list, which is the last thing you want to do when you're feeling bad. But the more you focus on the things you have to be grateful for, the better you feel. It's because we changed our focus. We look at what's good about life instead of what's bad about life. And as a matter of fact, I'm talking about things being bad. I heard that somebody said that you should never commit suicide on a bad day. And the reason is that they said, however you feel at the time you commit suicide, that's the way you're going to feel all through eternity. Yeah, they said, so you should always wait to kill yourself on a good day. But anyhow, I need to keep my focus on what's good about life rather than what's bad about life. I think that's one of the major things that's happened to me in AA, is to find that I have that choice. I not only have that choice, I have that responsibility. I find a lot of times in the morning I'll get up and I'll go out in the world and I'll early in the day is a good time to do it. And I'll ask people, I'll say, are you going to have a good day today? And it's interesting the answers you get. They don't know what we know, because we're taught that AA means altered attitudes, and that our attitude is our choice. And then I remember one time I was asked this young girl, and I said, "You gonna have a good day today?" And she said, "Oh, I have to work today." And I remember asking another one, and she said, "Well, that depends." In other words, her attitude depended on what was going to happen that day. She didn't know she had a choice in that. I remember another gal, I asked her, and she got real defensive. She said, "What's the matter? Doesn't I look like I'm having a good day yet?" You know. God, I don't want to fight about it. I just want to know if you're going to have a good day. That's why on the program they say, give yourself a good day, unless you've got other plans. But that's been an important thing for me. And the same way with this talk, I used to think I had to get along well with the people out there, and if I did well with them, then I'd be comfortable inside. In fact, I used to pretend to be what I thought people wanted me to be so that they would like me. And I thought if they liked me, then I would like me. And today I find I do just the opposite of that. I act as if I were the person I want to become in order to become that person. I will act unafraid in order to become unafraid. I will act spiritual in order to become spiritual. I will act loving in order to become loving. Not in order to fool somebody else, but in order to change me. It makes all the difference in the world. But I had to learn to get along with the people, with the personalities in my head, rather than with the people out there. And the more comfortable I get with the people in my head, the easier it is to get along with the people out there. And that's where the steps in the program has come in for me. I love the first step, where the powerlessness. I find that most of the time when I'm upset about something, it's because I'm working on trying to change something over which I'm powerless, such as somebody else's attitude. Very easy for me to pick up on Max's attitude and want to change her rather than changing myself. But I'm powerless over her attitude. But when I find that out, then I find I have no responsibility to that, and I can relax and go on with other things. Speaking of her attitude, Father Barney used to come down from Seattle area and put on retreats for Alcoholics Now and On. And he used to break sobriety down. He said it was like a baseball diamond. And he said that first base was physical sobriety, second base was mental sobriety, third base was emotional sobriety, and home plate was spiritual sobriety. I like that. I like breaking things down into parts that I can handle. I wondered how I got to first base without God's help. And somebody pointed out, well, you can't get to first base without starting at home plate. And so I thought, well, that's fine. I understand that. And it seemed to me that we get physically sober, and then we take the first step. We admit our powerlessness over alcohol. And then the second step is just this side of second base, the mental sobriety. Come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And the rest of the steps are distributed out around the rest of the steps. And it seems to me that we spend our lives in recovery on that diamond, either progressing into spiritual sobriety, further into it, or unconsciously drifting back toward the drink. Seems to me we don't spend time standing still. We're either moving forward or drifting backward. And I like that concept. And it's the same way with the staying sober. When I decided that I came to this meeting for the 7 months, like I said, and finally accepted the fact that I was a mild alcoholic. Then I decided that I would make a commitment to AA and to sobriety. Every time I had tried to quit drinking before, I ended up getting drunk. And I remember you talked about this, doing it a day at a time. I always thought that wouldn't do any good, to be doing it one day at a time. What good would one day do? But I decided to try it. In fact, I decided I just won't drink today and see what happens. And nothing happened. And so I decided to try it for another day. And nothing happened that day. And that's what I've been doing. One day at a time, I just don't drink. Today's a very important day for me. Today's the day I don't drink. I drank many yesterday, and I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. In fact, I don't know if I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. But when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time, and if it's today, I won't drink today. And that seems to be working very well for me, and I can handle the voices in my head a day at a time. And I no longer fight with them, and I listen to their talking. In fact, even like we were talking tonight at dinner about whether or not I drink caffeine. I used to have to give those people in my head drugs to either wake them up or put them to sleep. I'd have to get them to settle down and go to sleep before I could go to sleep. And now, today I'm really impressed with how sensitive they are, even to caffeine. I, I mean, the talk up there is talk, 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 talk. But even if I drink caffeine now, it's just like talk, 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 talk. You know? I'll get home from a meeting like this, and my body will want to lie down and go to sleep. My brain will say, no, let's lay here and talk about it for a while. You know? I'll get to sleep even in 3 o'clock in the morning. They'll say, hey, wake up. We've had an emergency meeting, and we need to talk to you. You know? You'll say, hey, you know that thing that you thought you handled so well and went so well today? It wasn't like that at all. I mean, they're really ticked off at you. Wait till morning, you'll find out, you know. And I think, God, I don't want to listen to that crap, and I'll roll over and go back to sleep. And just as I'm about to lose consciousness, I'll think, boy, I'm sure glad I'm not thinking about that anymore. And then one will say, oh, I'm glad you're still awake. You know, that's not the only time you did that. In fact, about 6 months ago, you did the same dumb thing. In fact, we've decided you're one of the dumbest people we've ever met. And let's spend the rest of the night making lists of dumb things you have done. And they really can tie into me. And speaking of having to put them to sleep and wake them up, what I did, I've always had a sleeping problem. I was born with congenital insomnia. And if you want to go crazy, decide you have a sleeping problem and then decide to work on it. The real example of working on the problem makes it worse. I mean, working on any problem for me makes the problem worse. In fact, I don't even have a problem until I get to thinking I have one. You know, think about that for a minute. I don't have a problem unless I think I do. No matter what anybody else thinks, if I don't think I have a problem, I don't have a problem. And I alone determine, if I have a problem, I alone determine the size of my problem. If I think it's a big problem, it's a big problem. And if I think it's a little problem, it's just a little problem. I don't have many little problems, though. I don't bother with them. Like resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. Or even if I have a little problem, all I have to do is think about it and watch it grow. And my mind puts energy into whatever it thinks about. And I can take any little problem and just think about it and watch it grow. In fact, I don't even have to start with a problem. I can start with a non-problem. I say, well, hell, that's no problem. Well, I suppose if you thought about it, it could be a little bit of a problem. And the bigger it gets, the easier it is to keep thinking about it. And pretty soon I'm thinking, my God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. You know, everybody else is missing it. You know? And another thing about problems is problems are extremely fickle. You can't neglect problems. Problems are like premature infants. They need a tremendous amount of attention and care and observation. They have to stay right with the problems and worry about it. Stay with them. That's why people calling on the phone can be very distracting to working on your problems. Because you get on the phone and people get to talk to me. And even if you know the answer to the problem, you can't just up and give it to them. You have to listen. You have to sound interested. You have to do active listening. That's the thing you're supposed to do, active listening. That means you ask them questions like, and then what did you do? And then how did you feel? Oh, tell me more. And then what else happened after that? And you keep asking them questions until neither one of you can stand it anymore. Yeah. And by that time, you've given the answer. What's the answer to you? Pick a number from 1 to 12. Work that step. Write a gratitude list. Write the serenity prayer. And then you go back to your problem, you find out your problem didn't wait around for you. It just went off and it'll go find somebody who'll give them more attention. More problems are solved by ignoring them than by working on them. Speaking of working on problems, I mentioned resentment. I told this story the other night. I would never tell a story like this, but was a David Biscott. You know, David Biscott, the psychiatrist on TV and radio, he's written some books. And he had this one book on various emotional symptoms and what you do about them. And I didn't think he could tell us anything, but I was leafing through the book to see what he had. And he had a thing on resentment. It's a word I hadn't even heard much before I came into AA. And I thought, well, he's not going to be able to tell us anything about resentments. But he said, he's telling us what to do about if you resent somebody. He says, you write their name on a piece of paper. And I thought, okay. And he says, write it in bold letters. I said, okay. And he says, tear it up. I said, okay. He says, tear it up vigorously. I said, okay, I'll tear it up vigorously. He says, then throw it in the toilet. I said, okay, I'll throw it in the toilet. He says, then use the toilet. Yeah. I thought, now that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. How do you fit that in with our prayer, our program of where we pray for the person? You know? I thought, well, I guess you could pray for the SOB while you're using the toilet. I don't know. I wouldn't even tell her, but he told that story. Anyhow, one of the things that I've noticed in the program is one of the things I noticed about the program is the definitions of love. That's a word I have has so many uses, so many meanings to it. I find it very confusing. But on the program, I've heard people define love. Don G says, love is an active concern for another person's welfare. An active concern for another person's welfare. In fact, I remember one night, it didn't seem very late to me, I called up Chuck C. And I said, what's your definition of love? And he says, it's the same thing at 11 o'clock in the morning it is at 11 o'clock at night. And I thought, well, geez, you're a crabby old fool. I said, yeah, but what is it? He says, it's action. Bang, and he hung up. And love is action. And I've heard other definitions that I like. But one that I heard, the reason I got interested in love, let me go back a minute. I think an alcoholic is a person who can't control their drinking once they start, and who also can't keep from starting. I not only can't drink successfully, sanely, sensibly, socially, I can't drink with a damn, but I also can't keep from drinking. So I can't drink and I can't not drink. That's a dilemma. And what that means is, without AA, I'm screwed. And I just can't drink and I cannot drink. And my efforts to control my drinking make it worse. The more energy I put into the problem of controlling my drinking by myself, the worse it gets. And yet, my efforts to help you control your drinking help me. I can't help me, but I can. My efforts to help you help me, whether you stay sober or not. It's just a lot more fun if you do, but it's not essential. That's my gift. I can give away to somebody else something I can't give to myself, but I get it back by giving it away. And it's my feeling that an alcoholic is my theory about alcoholism. I like to believe this, and even if it isn't true, don't tell me. I like my theory. I like to believe that an alcoholic or a chemically dependent person is a person who, whether they want to or not, and perhaps even especially if they don't want to, but whether they want to or not, they generate a great deal of love, but lack the ability to express love. And because they generate more and more of the feeling of love and can't express it, it builds up like pressure in a tea kettle. It becomes very uncomfortable. And so they put alcohol and drugs in order to suppress that feeling. And instead of that helping, it doesn't cure the problem, it makes them feel better temporarily, but it compounds the communication problem and makes the situation worse. Not only can they not express love, but can't receive love either. And so as a result, the people who live with us, the people who love us, they can't express their love either. Kind of the same disease in that sense. And the pressure keeps building up, but it has to come out, but it can't come out as love. So it comes out as negative emotions, resentments, anger, hostility, maybe violence. It just gets worse, all of which keeps compounding the communication problem and making it worse and worse. There's no place to go for relief from that until they end up as newcomers in AA, Al-Anon, whatever. And what do we do with newcomers? I think we just love the hell out of them. We love the hell out of their hellish lives. We love them to help. We love each other to help. In fact, you're doing it right now. Just sitting here listening, even if you can't hear what I'm saying or you don't like what I'm saying, you sit attentively, you're listening to another alcoholic share, and that helps you. That's an act of love on your part. It's an act of love on the part of the person that's up here taking the risk, whatever risk there is, to share. And it's lovely. We love each other to help. That's why people are so... I've always been impressed with how attentive people are at AA meetings, because whether they like it or not, that's because they're loving. It's not... they're not learning so much as they're loving each other to help. And I am... in fact, it's what we're doing, really, is we make each other feel important, because we are. And we do that with the newcomers. We have you stand up and make a fool of yourself, as a matter of fact. And we say, you newcomers are the lifeblood of this organization. I was thinking the other day, I wonder if that's what St. Peter says when he sees new people coming to the Golden Gate. You newcomers are the lifeblood of this organization. But the idea of feeling important, I decided to do that with Max. I thought, how can I express my loving concern for Max other than just keep saying, I love you, which seems to me is kind of a meaningless term in a way. And I thought, one of the ways I can do that is I can make her feel important. And I decided one of the ways I could make her feel important is to... Max likes to wake up to... No, that's not true. Max hates to wake up. When she wakes up, she likes to wake up to a hot cup of coffee. Now, she doesn't like hot coffee, and she doesn't like cold hot coffee. She likes hot coffee with two ice cubes that haven't melted yet. And the reason she likes them to not have melted yet, then she sees they're there. I mean, if they've already melted her, she starts her day off with a problem. You know, did you put the ice cubes in this coffee? So she likes to see them. So she likes to wake up to see on her bedside stand a cup of coffee with two ice cubes that haven't melted. And I get up before Max does. Actually, the whole world gets up before Max does. I take care of Lily and Sabrina. And I go to my typewriter, my computer. I used to hand and pencil, and I write letters to God, writing, automatic writing. And then I taught myself to type. I taught my fingers to type. But now I use the computer. And I type off a fast letter to God. Dear God, here we go again. You've been doing a good job. Let's see what you can do with this one. I used to start off with gratitude list, and he got so sick of reading them, he says, why don't we just skip that part? And so I tell him, I said, you take this day, and you do with it whatever you want. I said, you take this day, and you have come into my life, whoever you want to have come into my life today. You have them say whatever you want them to have them say, and you have them do whatever you want them to do. And I'll know that whatever happens this day, and whoever comes into my life, whatever they say and do, I'll know that's your will for me this day. Now you go have a good day, and I'll have a good day, and I'll check with you tomorrow. And it's kind of that business of I'll pedal and you steer. You know? And for God's sake, watch where you're going. Because I'm sick of some of the places we've been. And I also do the same thing with a problem. If I have a problem, I'll start out this Dear God thing and I'll write as fast as I can, automatic writing. No punctuation, no concern for grammar or anything like that, not worrying about anybody reading it, because nobody else is going to read it, neither am I. But I want to make sure that he knows that I know that he knows what the problem is. And I outline the whole thing. And you know, the more I've done that, the more often the answer, an answer, comes to me before I finish writing the problem. And if it doesn't come while I'm writing, it comes throughout the day, or that night, or I'll waken with it the next morning. But it comes to me intuitively when I'm doing something else. God speaks to me mostly in intuitive answers. And in fact, I was talking about all the people in my head and all the noise and chatter that goes on up there. And interestingly, the odd part, the most odd part about that is that in the very center of me is a center of calm. And I found that's where my higher power is. And that's where he's been all along. And I didn't know that. I went looking for him in all sorts of odd places, and I found he's right there with me. And the thing about that is, no matter where I go, he's with me. And the result is, I can go anywhere and face anybody and do anything, and nobody can harm me. Because the only way they can harm me is to make me take a drink. And with this program and my higher power with me, nobody can make me take a drink. And that's a great comfort to me. It's a great comfort to me. He's always there. I'm never alone anymore. Anyway, about the time I get through with all my talking to God, it's time for the queen to wake up. And so I decided to go make her coffee. And she doesn't like brewed coffee. She likes instant coffee. As long, well, I know, but it has to be Yuban, though. And you don't boil the water. You take the water out of a hot water dispenser. Hot water dispenser, you have a spigot over here, and there's a tube goes down into the sink, and there's a tank under there. And you have to hire a man, and he has to drill a hole about that big in the stainless steel sink that replaced the perfectly good white porcelain sink that was there. But it dispenses water at just the right temperature for putting two ice cubes in it. And she doesn't like milk at all. She doesn't like cream. She likes cream more, powdered cream, lots and lots of it. She likes a level teaspoonful of Yuban and two heaping teaspoonful of cream more. You put that in the bottom of the cup, and then you run the hot water in, and you swish the cup around like this so it mixes. And you don't want to use the spoon because you might want to use it again and want it dry. But so you swish it around. But you don't swish too hard because it'll go over the top and it'll make the bottom of the cup wet. You know, and she doesn't like to get the hoppy on her bedside stand. And also you don't want to go too full anyhow because you got to put two ice cubes in, and you don't drop them in because they'll slosh it over the side. You got to slide them in, you know. And you slide them in, and then you be careful and hear the bottom of the cup dry. And you walk into the darkened bedroom, and you be very careful. Don't walk on her high-heeled shoes in your bare feet, because it's very painful. And you have to be particularly careful as you go along the side of the bed, because those glossy magazines are very slippery. And when you get to the bedside stand on her side, you don't look for a bare spot, you just look for a level spot. And then you sneak out of the room and hope, you don't cheat. Now, you don't do anything to wake her up, you hope she will wake up before the ice cube's melt. Now, that, up to there, that is the easy part. The hard part is you don't dare hope that she will appreciate it. Because if you hope she appreciates it, then it's not love, it's barter. And Chuck Steele said that all the time. Love is for free and for fun, for free and for fun. If you expect anything in return, even appreciation, it's just barter. It's not love. Love is for free and for fun. And pretty damn strict rules, I thought. But I have to admit right off, Max is very cooperative. She never appreciates it. No. Anyway, that's my secret for staying married for 54 years. I don't want to close without giving some honorable mention to, I know this is an AA meeting, I presume it is, we talk about alcohol, but I do want to give some, at least some honorable mention to amphetamines. Somebody else must have taken some amphetamines. I don't think I would have had the physical stamina to have completed my pre-AA training period if it hadn't been for amphetamines. So. But I never got hooked on them. I never became a pill head. I didn't. I never ever took a pill unless I had the symptom. I did. I never ever took a pill. I had the very specific symptom that only that pill. I had it. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. And every pill I ever took, I swear, every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time. And prescribed by a doctor. And taken according to directions. And I never got hooked on pills. You can't get hooked on pills unless you abuse them. Ask any doctor. He'll tell you. The first thing he'll tell you is none of his patients ever get hooked on pills. But the patients who do get hooked on pills have to abuse them. He'll tell you that. Patients had to abuse the pill in order to get hooked on them. And I don't even know how to abuse the pill. How do you abuse the pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know. You stomp on the thing, or verbally abuse it. You dirty, rotten little pill, why didn't you do what I told you? The pills I took were very tiny little. You could look at them, you knew they were very mild. And I was very gentle with my pills. I was even very careful where I carried them. I used to carry them over with my change. And people say, "You got change for a dollar?" And I say, "Oh, yeah." "Well, I can." They say, "Oh, you're carrying such an all around in the daytime." Yeah. And I put it over with my keys, and I'd go to get in my car, and I'd take my keys out. Quaalude, run down the parking lot. Damn thing would always run faster than I could run. And I couldn't stomp on it, or I'd abuse it. I was very gentle with my pills, and I said I had a sleeping problem, and I found out at the end that I could work in the drugstore. I mean, I'd go to school all day, work in the family drugstore all the evening, study till midnight, 1, 2 o'clock, and I found I could drink a couple of beers, jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up smart. And that was the beginning of my working on my sleeping problem. And that ended with me drinking more, and see, every chemical I used worked. But every time I used a chemical to solve a living problem, because it worked, it made me more dependent on it the next time I had the problem. If I couldn't solve the living problem without the chemical in the first place, I'm less likely to solve it without the chemical in the second place. So I had increased my dependency by having it work. Plus the fact that as I used it over a period of time, it took more and more of the chemical to get the effect. Plus, as I used it over a period of time, the good effect lasted for a shorter and shorter period of time, so I had increased the speed at which I was using the chemical, plus the fact that every chemical over a period of time had side effects, so I had to take some other chemical to counteract the side effects the first one started. So my disease was really progressive. Really, it was a very progressive disease. And what I said, I took a couple of beers to sleep at night, I ended up working on my sleeping problem, I'd take pills all day, drink all the evening, decided it was time to go to sleep, I decided it was time to go to bed at night, and I wanted to inject some amitol in my vein. Surgeons, they do that in the hospital. They put an IV in, and they say, count to 10, you say 1, and zing, you're asleep. It's an instant blackout. Not as good as instant Demerol, but it's just instant. I used to put myself to sleep that way. I couldn't go to lie in bed and have my one daughter say, "Hey, Ann, come watch Daddy take his nightly fix." So I would keep my Amitol in my bag, and the bag in the car, and the car in the garage, and thank God the garage was attached to the house. And I did, after a full day of pill taking and drinking, and an evening of really getting and drinking, I decided to go out and I mix up the Panadol, stick the needle in my vein, I try to figure out how much can I squirt in, take it out, take it around, throw it in the bag, throw it in the bag in the car, slam the car door, run down the hall and jump in bed so I could fall asleep. That was really tricky to time it. I mean, just the least little bit, just the least little bit too much, then I'd just zing right under the car. But worse than that, and just the least little bit not enough, and I'd squirt it in, take it out, take it in, throw it in the bag, throw it in the bag, throw it in the bag, slam it, run down the hall, jump in bed, and nothing would happen. And half measures got me nowhere at all, and then I'd have to go back and do it over again. And I mean, take the needle out of the vein, you're supposed to put a Band-Aid over so it doesn't bleed all over the place. Well, I didn't have time to do that, so I would hold my arm up like that and hope gravity would do all this stuff one hand. I'd run down the hall with my hand up, and I'd run into Max and then try to act casual. You know what I mean? God, it's hard to be casual when you're in a hurry. And as I say, I ended up in the nut ward, and from there, when that wasn't bad enough, I had to go to AA, and then I finally surrendered to the fact that I couldn't do it myself. Somebody was showing me a system for making graphs on a computer, where you put data in the computer and the computer makes a pie graph or a vertical graph. Now I was thinking how if my life were graphed out, it started way, way over there, and it's going to end way, way, way over there. And from where it started until July 31st, 1967, when I turned into a mild alcoholic, my life was on a downhill course. Now, it wasn't a straight line down. It was up and down, up and down, up and down. It was just enough to keep me confused. And I would do something when it went down, it would get better, and I think I was getting someplace, but when it went down, it was downer than it was before last time it went down. So it ended up, as I say, in a nut ward and in AA. I accepted the fact that I was a mild alcoholic, decided I had to do something about it, and my life has been getting better and better and better ever since. Now, it's not a straight line up. It's up and down, up and down. Some days are better than others. Some weeks are better. Some months, some years are better than others. But the trend, long-term trend, is up and up and up. And it seems like there's no end in sight as to how high that can go. The only determination that I can think of is how long I can stay around doing what I'm doing that's working. If I keep doing it, I know it'll keep working, and my life will just keep getting better and better and better. And that makes me happy to have this program, happy to be an alcoholic and have this way to go. And it amazes me the impact of that decision that I was an alcoholic, to change that trend of the beat from going down, change the direction upward rather than downward. And the way I see it, what did I accept? It seems like I accepted the challenge of living life to its fullest in spite of the fact I can't drink like other people. It seems to me that as long as I resisted my alcoholism, it kept getting worse. And when I accept it, it gets better. It was the same way with the marriage. If I resist it and complain about it, it gets worse. If I accept it as it is, if I accept Max as she is, she changes, it seems like, and I change, and it keeps getting better and better. It seems like life loves the challenge. I mean, somebody says, don't ever tempt fate by saying it couldn't get worse. It'll always get worse. Life likes the challenge. If I resist life, it gets worse. If I accept it as it is, it gets better. I'm really impressed with how my life changed on the basis of that one act of acceptance of my disease. It seems like what I did was I went from living in the problem to living in the answer. If my focus is on the problem gets worse. If my focus is on the answer gets better. And I think, I know I went from the role of victim to the role of hero. I was always a victim in my life story. And when I accepted my alcoholism in this program, I became the hero in my own life story. In fact, I know I went from a whiner to a winner. And I said, you know, that's what AA is full of, winners. We've accepted the challenge of living life to its fullest in spite of the disease we have and doing the things we have to do about it. And I can't say that I'm proud to be an alcoholic, because as far as I know, I had nothing to do with it. I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol and other mind and mood affecting drugs and chemicals, and that's not at all unusual. All drugs are like that. Everybody reacts exactly the same to every drug, every medication, except for those people who react different. And I'm one of those who react different only to alcohol and to these drugs. And so I didn't ask for it, but that's the situation. And once I accepted the challenge of doing what I need to do to be with that, my life has gotten better. And I can't say that I'm proud to be an alcoholic. I'm glad to be an alcoholic, but I'm not proud to be an alcoholic, but I am proud. I'm very proud indeed to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's absolutely terrific. I just love being an alcoholic. It's the proudest thing in my life, that and my marriage and the other things, but I love being an alcoholic. I love being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank God for AA, and I thank AA for my sobriety. Thank you for a nice evening. That's it.